I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Welcome to episode 47 of Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. The title of this podcast episode is Nagorno-Karabakh. The future is dark and robotic. Some housekeeping is in order. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can go to my Substack page, Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. Or you can email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. Would love to hear from folks in the audience or folks who may have recommendations for future episodes or comments or questions about episodes I have produced so far. Just returned from Calizuela, where we had the annual Military Operations Research Society Symposium, of which I am a member and a working group chair. Had a great time. It is always a great meeting of the minds to, you know, rub shoulders and meet new folks. And just the intellectual ferment that I find at these conferences is just really tremendous. I gave a number of presentations, among which was a truncated version of what I'm about to present today to you in this episode. In this episode, it may be peppered with some of the observations that I made over the previous week. I do find some raging intelligence and critical thinking gaps, though, going on in the intellectual circles in the defense industrial complex, in which the U.S. and the West aren't quite recognizing what's on the horizon as far as near-peer and peer conflict. I have bloviated in the past on this show and others, such as when I've spoken with Scott Horton about what a problem it is to see the shift from fighting irregular warfare in the last conflicts that have occupied the first two decades of this new century, such as Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria and places in the Horn of Africa and such. It's been busy for the military as far as non-near-peer fights. But as far as near-peer and peer fights are concerned, and for those of you new to the podcast or may want some clarification on that term, what it means is that instead of fighting third world or developing world armies, which tend to be insurgencies and tend to be fighting shadowy, less organized complexes of threats that don't happen to have artillery, navies, aircraft, and the usual combatant blend and menu that we are accustomed to seeing in conventional military history. But all of that is on the horizon. And the force that is structured right now in the U.S., even though it can't win insurgency to save its life, and this goes along with the entire West, because if one were to take a look at what Africa and China has achieved on the continent of Africa, for instance, you would discover that military domination in Africa is now in balance Russian, not American, not French, and that soft power, civilizational, and infrastructure balance is Chinese and not U.S. or European. The balance has completely changed in Africa. It's been there for everybody to observe, but I've seen that the United States and the West are very slow in the uptake of what that's going to do in the future. For instance, I just saw a startling headline from our lower tier of first order navies, the last tier of first order navies, which would be the U.S. Navy. They said in a PR, and I don't know, they should fire the PR person who released this. They said, and I'm paraphrasing, "We have suffered the most intense naval combat since the end of World War II," that would be August 1945, "in the Red Sea, this against a foe that has no navy, in this case, the Houthis and Yemen proper." The U.S. Navy is in a sorry state, but the entirety of the Pentagon's $1 trillion per annum military-industrial complex and everything that is shit out of the end of it, creating these exquisite platforms, such as very large ships, air forces, tanks, and all of this stuff. I think what's happened is that no one has given the Pentagon the memorandum that we are in this 21st century, at the same place the West found itself December 8th, 1941, when every Western Navy on Earth woke up and discovered that naval aviation, and not capital battleships, not capital ships, not cruisers, none of the traditional naval gunnery platforms were going to win the naval conflict in the following years to come, but that it would be naval aviation. Churchill claims that one of his darkest days, and this was a man who was subject to black dog depression, was when the Prince of Wales and the Repulse were sunk on their way to Singapore to support themselves against the brilliant centrifugal strategy that the Japanese were executing from December 1941 to March 1942, where they bested the United States, the Canadians, the British, the Dutch, and small French holdings all throughout the entirety of Southeast Asia to cement the instantiation of their new Greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere in what is probably one of the greatest synchronized military invasion plans the world has ever seen, the Japanese centrifugal strategy that was executed during that time. To me, the very best treatment of that particular campaign was Rising Sun, Falling Skies, the disastrous Java Sea campaign of World War II by Jeffrey R. Cox, and I also recommend the three volumes that he did detailing the two-year minus campaign of Guadalcanal, where the Americans and other Allied forces wrested control from the Japanese. There are all kinds of exhibits that one can examine in totality that have caused this chaos avalanche, both in the performance, much less the manufacturing, of all of these exquisite platforms. And as I have bored you with before, but I will bore new listeners with now, the U.S. Navy, for instance, has not, since 1991, with the commissioning of the Arleigh Burke, had one single successful hull get wet in the ocean. This would include the little crappy ships. This would include the DDG 1000. I'm no naval architect, but it has a what's called a tumble home hull, which is supposed to be stealthy. And then, of course, we have the USS Ford, which cannot reliably launch and retrieve aircraft. And it cannot reliably launch and retrieve aircraft like the ones that they're retiring, and also the F-35 Bravo and Charlie. The Alpha being the Air Force airframe, the Bravo Charlie being the Navy and Marine Corps F-35s, respectively, that right now, I would remind all of you, between 2008, we've entered our, I think we've got 1,000 of these birds currently in service. I put that in air quotes, because the birds produced between 2008 and 2011 have an operational readiness rate of zero. This is according to the Air Force Secretary, his own self. And the Bravo Charlies, the ones I just mentioned for the Navy and Marine Corps respectively, produced between 2013 and 2023, have an operational readiness rate of 30% and lower. It's astonishing when America's and the West has these technologies, these manufacturing bases and such, in that, to a large extent, as I had told everybody who would listen when I went over how concepts of operations, concepts of employment, functional descriptions, at the baseline stage, when you build these vast weapon systems, especially those that are going to be longitudinally, horizontally, and vertically integrated throughout the force structure itself, with the attendant maintenance, with the attendant logistics, with the attendant revisioning of new products and such, I get the impression that none of them did that. For instance, if I were king for a day and I was in charge, not only would I close all 800 bases overseas and bring all of those folks home so that we could protect the homeland, I would take a very serious reappraisal at every exquisite platform that we have and see what has to be retired and what doesn't. For instance, when they considered the little crappy ships that they developed, which are being retired 5 years into their 30-year shelf life, you're welcome, taxpayers. If my consideration for a littoral combat ship were of any notice whatsoever to anybody who was concerned, I think that the Navy could have done itself a terrific service by going out of its nuclear submarine portfolio and adopting existing diesel-electric submarine hulls that are out there. The Europeans make some tremendous ones, like the German 214s and 217s. You should examine those at your leisure and see what you think of those. The Germans, when it comes to diesel-electric technology, they were at the cutting edge of World War I. They're at the cutting edge right now. Well, how long that cutting edge will last, I'm not certain, because remember, the Germans have volunteered now for the Morgenthau Plan instead of having it imposed upon them. My critiques are wide and deep when it comes to force structure, and I think that this reliance on exquisite platforms is a great preamble for what we're going to talk about today, and that's going to be Nagorno-Karabakh, which happens to be a little piece of land that is in the western portions of Azerbaijan proper, and it was between Azerbaijan and Armenia that this whole conflict started in the fall of 2020. Let me rephrase that. It didn't start then. It's been brewing, and it's lit hot from smolders on occasion for decades. But it really came into its own on that particular occasion in the fall of 2020, where Azerbaijan really cleaned Armenia's clocks. And mind you, both of these former Soviet client states, then to become Russian client states, Azerbaijan betting the most on remaining a coalition partner in the NATO variant that Russia had acceded to and coalesced into existence after the USSR fell in 1991. And you have the dozen or less stand brothers on the former USSR underbelly calved off in their own respective countries, but maintained alliances of one sort or another with Russia proper under the nuclear umbrella, probably Machiavellian intrigue and palace whispers going on to ensure that they would not fall into the orbit of the West, but would remain in the influence orbit of the Russians themselves. But before we do that, let's set the stage. I want to set the stage here with revolutions and military affairs. Revolutions and military affairs, quite simply, are those moments in history where all of a sudden one thing is discovered. It could be a tactic, it could be a technique, it could be a technology. In most instances, it happens to be a technology. One of those technologies would be the stirrup and how that revolutionized cavalry and dragoon tactics. The distinction between both of those is that cavalry is horse-borne, fighting is horse-borne, whereas dragoons tend to be horse-borne, but they dismount at the time in which they are going to go into combat and melee. We can look at riflery. We can look at muskets. We can look at smokeless powder. We can look at the difference between second- and third-generation warfare, which is attrition warfare versus maneuver warfare, and we see the first instances of that peeking from behind the curtain during the American Civil War, that second American Civil War that took place 1860 to 1865. I call it second because the first American Civil War was from 1775 to 1783 when the divorce from London took place. Because remember when Paul Revere was on his ride on the late evening of April 19th, 1775, he did not say, as Disney would tell us, the British are coming because he was British in the saddle. He said, the regulars are out. The redcoats are out, which meant the regular army under whose suzerainty they were not serving too well was out to punish the British colonialist as it is by seizing munitions, artillery rounds, powder, and that kind of thing. If you wish to take the time to delve into just what that was, listen to episode 11, which is Three Strikes of the Match, where I talk about that very consequential 24 to 48 hours on April 19th, 1775, that inaugurated the divorce proceedings, as it were, from the United Kingdom. Now, prior to the special military operation, Russia versus Ukraine, there was this tiny geographical ink spot of Nagorno-Karabakh that proved the future was dark and robotic. The follow-on Russian invasion merely confirmed the RMA that appeared in the fall of 2020, almost like a spooky preamble to what was to occur when the Russians invaded Ukraine proper. In my opinion, for the most part, and I'm certain that we can find outliers to this prognostication, all kinetic conflicts come down to angles, surprise, and synchronization. And of course, as I've said repeatedly, all conflicts are won by the least incompetent army. Nagorno-Karabakh is a region of southwestern Azerbaijan. I urge you to take a look at a map if you get the opportunity. The name is also used to refer to the autonomous oblast, which is Russian for province, of the former Azerbaijan Soviet Socialist Republic, and to the Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh, a self-declared country whose independence is not internationally recognized. The old autonomous region occupied an area of about 1,700 square miles, while the forces of the self-proclaimed Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh occupied some 2,700 square miles. The general region includes the northeastern flank of the Karabakh Range of the Lesser Caucasus and extends from the crest line of the ridge to the margin of the Kura River lowland at its foot. Now, Nagorno-Karabakh, we're going to call it NG from now on, just for brevity's sake. Environments vary from steppe, and that would be steppe, as in mountains, on the Kura lowland through dense forests of oak, hornbeam, and beech on the lower mountain slopes, to birchwood and alpine meadows higher up. The peaks of the Karabakh Range culminate in Mount Gyamish, which is 12,218 feet. Vineyards, orchards, mulberry groves for silkworms are intensively developed throughout the valleys of NG. Cereal grains are grown, and cattle, sheep, and pigs are kept. The region has some light industry and many food processing plants. Now, mind you, it is my conceit that this tiny ink spot of a region has changed the entire complexion of warfare for the 21st century, and the U.S. and West should take advantage of that because this crisis went red hot in 2020. Amid the heightened tensions, clashes once again broke out on September 27th, 2020, and with both sides more prepared for sustained fighting than they had been in July, and with Azerbaijan emboldened by Turkey's firm support, Turkey would provide them with some very, probably some of the highest technology and practical military UAV usage on planet Earth right now. And they'd been fighting since the 1990s. Heavy casualties and damage were sustained from a brutal ground war aided by the use of cluster munitions and ballistic missiles. That would be IRBMs more so than ICBMs, so intermediate range. The fighting was further characterized by the use of drones whose footage helped fuel an extensive information war on social media. Now, there are a variety of lessons learned for the U.S. and West and interested laymen out there who are interested in military affairs and want to know what the future portends. You've got to know yourself and you've got to know your enemies. The Azeris had reviewed the underlying causes of their previous defeat at the hands of the Armenian Armed Forces. They meticulously studied their current capabilities and adapted and incorporated new ways of warfare, which enabled them to decisively win the conflict in 44 days. Better equipment, better organization, better training, preparation, and leadership were key. Mind you, while this conflict in 2020 was won in 44 days, the conflict is still brewing on and off. The embers are still, any moment, the war can take itself into reality once again. But the Armenians got their asses kicked. Now, you've heard me say before that surprise is a very large part of successful conflict throughout the ages, in that what we find with this is that the Azeris set the conditions for success before the fight. They had cultivated strategic relationships with both Turkey and Israel, providing them with access to sophisticated ISR and strike UAS and loitering munitions. For those who don't know, a loitering munition is a maneuverable munition, most likely one that it could have helicopter blades at all four corners, could weigh under 50 pounds, could weigh as much as a ton. And it has a maneuverability in which it can loiter by either being a helicopter-borne PGM or have wings and horizontal thrusters that would allow it to loiter by spinning figure eights or holes in the sky. And they also introduced hesitation with Armenia's sponsor, Russia, causing them to equivocate whether the defense of the Inkay region fell within the scope of the Armenian-Russian mutual defense agreement. Striking first was also important for them, and they had an innovative use of obsolete, remotely piloted air assets to probe and force Armenian air defense radars to light up, which enabled the Azeris to then fix, target, and destroy the Armenian layered air defenses using precision weapons, granting them first mover advantage. In this case, what it would be, we've often heard that you have integrated air and missile defense, which is IAMD. We've often heard that with the Chinese, for instance, and you will find this on the Russian border with Ukraine, they also have significant IAMD, and they also have aerial denial and air defense, which is A2AD. And what that provides them with is a perimeter defense, and more likely than not, in order to succeed in that kind of defensive barrier, you have to have a depth of defense in which you have iterative and even redundant qualities of what's going to take out what if it comes perpendicularly through the corridor. Gosh, is perpendicular even a word? I doubt it. The Azeris sought to dominate across all the domains. While the maritime domain did not factor significantly in this conflict, take a look at NK, you'll see that it's landlocked and that there's not a lot of littoral conflict that's going to be going on there, much less riverine. The Azeris dominated all other domains, successfully synchronizing their actions across the air, land, cyber, and even the space domains with their Turkish-supplied Beyrolder TB2 ISR and Strike UAS is leveraging Turkish satellites to communications links and thereby having the synchronization effort work. Fire synchronization, and I would urge all of you, and I'll put this in the show notes, to review my colleague Les Grau from the Foreign Militaries Studies Organization, FMSO. He wrote a very interesting and detailed assessment of Russian reconnaissance strike fires complex and the way the Russians had finally found a way to synchronize their sensors and effectors and their tactical and operational and to a certain extent even their strategic depth so that with hasty and deliberate targeting, hasty being that's call for fires that haven't been planned for, deliberate being planned for registered artillery fires as it were, they were able to capitalize on the ability to put metal on target in under 30 seconds, which has been a goal of the newly revised Russian armed forces ever since 2008 and their battles in South Ossetia, which I would say was probably the hallmark and preamble to the renaissance that we've seen in Russian arms since that time. And of course, this two-year special military operations into Ukraine has done nothing but home that weapon to a very sharp focus. The U.S. and the West have no such synchronization of fires coordination at the tactical and operational level, despite the lip service that they give to it. Take a look at JADC2, CJADC2, ABMS, all very ambitious projects with a lot of money dumped into them that have not come up with a seamless and timely near real-time, much less real-time, synchronization of all fires assets that may be on the battlefield at the time. Because the battlefield is becoming increasingly transparent. Despite camouflage, Armenian command post and air defense assets were easily targeted and destroyed. If you are sensed, you are targeted. And if targeted, you are destroyed and rendered inoperable or neutralized. Because sensors are more important than the shooters. But then again, those sensors' ability to communicate to the shooters is what gives them the capability from a conflict perspective to take distributed lethality, harness that to targeting, so that you can actually use distributed lethality, which was a Navy term from the 90s and the early aughts that they did not take advantage of, nor do the intellectual heavy lifting to capitalize on, in order to strike at targets and make them neutralized or destroyed. Because since sensors are more important than shooters, enabling shooters to now execute with greater precision than ever before, why not take advantage of that technology and that TTP if you've got it? High-definition, full-motion, real-time videos from UAS and loitering munitions not only allowed the Azeris to target and destroy Armenian systems and personnel, but provided intelligence, battle damage, intelligence, followed by assessment. Speaking of Argo, by the way, we hear BDA so often, battle damage assessment. Battle damage assessment can't take place without battle damage intelligence being the prelude to that very action taking place. So when you hear BDI and BDA, they're usually not used correctly when you see the talking heads on TV. What it means is that there's nowhere to hide. As a matter of fact, as a former grunt myself, an infantryman who I'd like to characterize as homeless people with guns, the days of the 11 Bravo, the light infantryman, the infantryman who is the boots on the ground, and the 0311s, the infantry counterpart in Uncle Sam's Misguided Children, while up until the end of the 20th century, you needed infantrymen to take and hold ground. There's no doubt that that remains the case, but it is exponentially harder now when you've seen some of these heart-wrenching videos that is coming out of the current conflict between the Ukraine and Russia, where a drone would go over a singleton soldier, and it appears that the soldier was pleading with the drone, and then the drone detonated right above him. I wonder at, especially with the panoply of sensors and MASINT intelligence disciplines and such, is there going to be a way for a human being on the battlefield to hide thermally or even physically from very cheap drones in the salvo competition here? Because remember, when it comes to salvo competition, you have exquisite platforms on one end, then you move your way left on that schematic, and you find that you're at attritable platforms. Then you come to expendable platforms. And of course, there will be officers in the Pentagon who will probably make the next rank by teasing out what the precise terminology has to be, but I would certainly say that when it comes to affordable mass, what Stalin told us about quantity having a quality all its own, affordable mass and expendable munitions are probably married to each other. Because as I just mentioned here, masking is essential to survive in the future battle space. And NK gave us a preview to that, and the Russians and the Ukrainians are showing just what that looks like on the ground. Masking is a full-spectrum effort, engaging all active and passive measures to make systems and personnel hard to target, hard to locate, hard to localize, hard to neutralize. Camouflage is no longer enough. As a matter of fact, camouflage, the physical camouflage that one sees in the World War II movies, or if you happen to have served in the armed forces, that you would put on your exposed flesh outside of your uniform and under your helmet, it may not be necessary anymore because it may be a moot point. We've got to define and study and promote the concept of masking as a key element of war, possibly elevating it to separate principles of war. Our mantra has to be mask or die. That's quite literally the case. And this would include emissions conditions, what's referred to in the military argo as MCON. You're going to find that everything from that singleton 11 Bravo soldier, maybe he's on a fire team, maybe he's in a platoon, maybe he's in a company, wherever he may be engaged in a combat environment, in a non-permissive, contested environment, he is going to be targeted and sensed. And by being targeted and sensed, he will make himself open to rather cheap munitions, whether it's a Lancet 3 drone at $50,000 a pop, or maybe mortar and artillery rounds that are coming in and landing on your head as a result of third-party targeting by loitering ISR birds that are aloft. Emission conditions, naval ships out there that don't use passive acquisition radar, but use active acquisition radar, can be traced to where they are and destroyed. And I would suggest that the U.S. Navy's rather foolish ambitions when it comes to either the suzerainty of the U.S. Navy and its allies in the Western Pacific that is bound by Chinese influence, or in a cross-strait invasion of Taiwan and trying to stop that, for the most part, all the capital ships, all the warships in the U.S. Navy are going to be in the hazard, to include the carrier forces, of which my persistent and perennial listeners know I think should be retired tomorrow morning and turned into reefs or maybe hotels or gambling casinos, but they certainly don't serve as effective warships in the 21st century. Get rid of them. Many listeners know that I constantly bag on all the technology that the U.S. and the West tends to come out with. One thing that I find that we probably have best of breed on would be our small arms, to include the M16 M4 platform, of which private businesses have been the leading innovator for that Stoner platform since 1956. It hasn't been military labs that have made them better. It has been private companies from which one can buy them and experiment with them, everything from optics to the Lego builds of the air itself. You'll notice, too, that the M249, which is the 5.56 squad machine gun, and the M240 Bravo, which is the 7.62 squad or platoon machine gun, you'll find them in heavy weapons organizations, also in infantry organizations throughout the West. Very good. The Javelin, of course, is an amazingly effective weapon for the price and what it does. It is a top-down destroyer. And traditionally, everything from tanks, which tend to be more thin-skinned on the top, to revetments or anything but a deliberate ammunition supply point and such. Like, when you have your soldiers digging in, and they've either dug everything from a shell scrape to a very sophisticated wooden-bound structure, roofs tend to be the part of it that can be compromised most easily through terminal guidance and the kind of energy that can be delivered once that terminus comes to a very sudden halt. Aziri UAVs and loitering munitions provided them with a relatively inexpensive substitute for conventional air power. Any state, or non-state actor for that matter, with the resources to purchase top attack systems on the global market, has the potential to achieve that kind of supremacy. As a matter of fact, possibly air supremacy. Not only would I suggest that carriers have seen their day, I think the day of manned tanks and manned aircraft are numbered. I hate to break the bad news to those of my audience who are either active duty in an either one of those, or have been active duty and happen to be retired, or didn't retire and just got out and went into the corporate sector. Those are the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century and need to be disposed of as soon as possible. You've often heard me talk about salvo competition, which is what's going to happen with leakers, because salvo competition is a war of the leakers. What it means is that no matter how robust your defenses may be, something's going to get through. I remember this past week we were having a discussion on IAMD, which is Integrated Air and Missile Defense, and I was talking about, well, what are some of the most high-intensity situations we've been in that sort of replicate what's happening and what I think the future is going to be crowded with as far as UAVs coming in by the hundreds, possibly thousands. Swarms, whether those swarms are deliberate, independently steered as one would see a flock of birds, or just a rather anarchic swarming where they go in every different direction but finally end up in your lap, is when you look at the kamikaze fight off of Okinawa in May of 1945, I think that that is a very good instructional episode, although it's going to have its warts and variables that have nothing to do with the 21st century, but we have very little to look at now as far as how does one defend against drone swarms. And I would suggest if there's anybody in my audience or you wish to pass on to a colleague, somebody can probably make a very interesting study of saying, what is swarming munitions going to look like as far as how one would defend against those when we encounter that in the near peer and peer fight in the future. For those of you who would like to entertain the thought experiment of just what that would look like, there is an extraordinary book out by a gentleman by the name of Arnold S. Lott called Brave Ship, Brave Men, about the USS Aaron Ward's fight for one day against kamikazes in 1945, and what that looked like, felt like, and how bloody awful it was. Because, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, when it comes to being a missile sponge, it's not about getting hit by hundreds of missiles. It's about being hit by the leakers, being hit by those that make their way through the allegedly impenetrable shield that you put up with either lead or kinetic or non-kinetic means to stop these UASs, UAVs, missiles, whatever it may be, from coming in and either scraping the paint on a vessel or actually sinking that vessel with all hands. Long-range precision fires will dominate future fights. Azeri's use of both dumb and smart artillery fire in conjunction with the UAS and brilliant loitering munitions enabled them to win decisively in just 44 days, as I had mentioned. There was no decisive close combat fight. We need to develop our own in the West and in the U.S. standoff strike capabilities while simultaneously denying our adversaries the use of theirs. But in the best of circumstances, as I've indicated, in the end, this will be a war of leakers. Active protection systems in air defense. Active defense systems are needed to survive in the new battle space in the 21st century. Armenian ground forces had about 7 seconds to react to incoming strikes by UAS and loitering munitions, resulting in devastating crises in their soldiers' morale and will to fight and the loss of all the organizational equipment that they had. Layered, multi-capable air defense against top attack munitions, missiles, aircraft, and low-speed and high-speed threats is vital, and these are things that the U.S. still hasn't addressed in a substantive fashion that works. This is a Manhattan Project, because in the end, this isn't simply about stopping massed fires from landing on whatever one has deployed as combat forces in the tactical and operational zones forward from the rear of the front line of troops to forward of it in the restricted operating zones and such. This is a fight about leakers. This is a fight about those discrete ones that are, they didn't get hit by chance, by happenstance, by Clausewitzian fog or friction, whatever the case may be. This is going to be a fight where those leakers, out of the thousands or tens of thousands of munitions traded, these wars are going to be won by less than hundreds of them. Look, you've heard me say the future of warfare. Well, in this case, I'm saying it's dark and robotic, but the future of warfare is going to be all about robotics, autonomous targeting, and hypervelocity munitions, and everything in between. It is going to completely upend and remove all the military notions, for the most part, that have informed the last 1,000 years of armed conflict east and west. Warfare is accelerated. Robots and automation mean that battles will be increasingly executed faster than ever before. The trend will turn the existing kill chain into a kill web, where artificial intelligence will prioritize and synchronize weapons engaging targets across multiple domains. The synchronization will be AI-led, not humans in the loop. And I get it. A lot of people are frightened by this notion. It's not as if we don't have autonomous targeting, though. Ask anybody who's been around a CWIS in Afghanistan, or they've seen the phalanx, what looks like an R2-D2, on the deck of ships with their walls of steel they send up for incoming. Those are autonomously targeted weapon systems. And of the trifecta I described, hypervelocity munitions, when it comes to perfecting those, if they're not perfected now, they will be perfected sometime in the future. And when I say perfect, I mean that they will be able to be effectively employed on the battlefield, whether we do that or they do that. And the real calculus, the real hard driver for this that's going to make it so bloody difficult is going to be the reception of hypervelocity munitions that are coming in as far as defending against those, especially if they can maneuver on their terminal glide, if they can maneuver while they're coming in. Because we are experiencing speeds for tactical and operational munitions, hypervelocity that is in excess of Mach 5, that we haven't encountered before en masse on the battlefield. Now, this is not to say that hypervelocity munitions are a brand new thing. They've been around since the end of World War II, because in the 1950s, when ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and IRBMs, intermediate range ballistic missiles, that's not necessarily new. What's going to be new is the quantity, terminal maneuvering, and the ability to have interceptors that are wedded between sensors and effectors that, absent a human in the loop, can actually service these inbound munitions coming in. Because if you have a human in the loop and you're trying to service a target that is coming at you with terminal maneuvering at more than Mach 5, by the time that decision is taken, that decision maker or the person who called in on the declaration of that very threat after they detected it, they're going to have it in their lap. So in summary, how did they prevail? Well, they prevailed because they took the time beforehand to plan it out, to make sure that they had all their ducks in a row, to make sure that they had munitions that not only were superior in technological efficacy, but they used them so that they could make the most effective tactics, techniques, and procedures to make sure that they won the conflict, and they did. This enabled those Azerbaijani forces to find, fix, track, and kill targets with precise strikes far beyond the front lines, by the way, over the horizon. UAVs were operationally integrated with fires from manned aircraft and land-based artillery, but also frequently used their own ordnance to destroy various high-value military assets, to include having UAVs out there that had no munitions on them whatsoever, but they were there to do the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance functionality of third-party targeting so that they could have a persistent and perennial 24/7, probably backed up and redundant system in which they could observe the battlefield. Now, this would also include, from an irregular warfare perspective, hybrid and gray zone things that would have to occur. Let's say you had influence operations going on with both black and white propaganda. You would have troops calling in fires at various areas that were forward of the line of troops that the mass of Azerbaijanis were there. And I think the primary lesson from the air war over NK is the importance of full spectrum air defense. Both Armenia and Azerbaijan's short-range air defense, their SHORAD arsenals, were limited in size and quality. Azerbaijan was able to exploit this gap with a large fleet of sophisticated drones. Affordable mass in salvo competition is critical in the next peer or near-peer flight. I'm going to repeat that sentence because those of you who happen to work in the Puzzle Palace of the DoD or the Pentagon, if you could find a way to send up the signal flare and make this known to everybody, because this one sentence is what is going to steer America and its allies, if they choose to victory or defeat. And that is, affordable mass and salvo competition is critical to victory or stalemate in the next near-peer or peer fight. Vertical and horizontal emissions control hygiene is going to be critical to survival, whether the West acknowledges that or not. So I want to repeat, this pursuit of exquisite multi-billion dollar, tens of billions of dollars in platforms, as I mentioned, we just, I think, made the 1,000th F-35, retiring a lot of the birds that are out there to include fighter aircraft. Once again, for so many reasons, there are reasons why the F-35 is just simply substandard, and I don't know how it's going to make it through its service life until 2050, especially with the maintenance concerns, the operational readiness ratings, software upgrade problems, and just what I would say is an existential chaos avalanche of a competency crisis throughout America and the West that is really starting to take its toll even in the DoD and the civilian manufacturing base. As I've mentioned before when I talked about carriers, we have two nuclear-capable shipyards in the United States. The United States and the West is always acting as a global hegemon, one reason why the Chinese and the Russians have such advantages in both defensive and offensive arms is because they are regional hegemons with no, for the most part, extraterritorial ambitions, excepting what we've seen with the Russians in the Middle East and Africa. But the soft power that we've seen exercised by the Chinese, who have no extraterritorial military strategic history whatsoever, and if they do the cross-strait invasion, this will be a new chapter in Chinese arms, as it were, when you think about the entirety of their history. But in order for the West to find its way in this, it needs to take a knee, it needs to take a pause, and it needs to reassess what it's prioritizing as far as conflict, war making, exquisite platforms. And whether the U.S. and the West admits it or not, affordable mass is the future. Robotics, autonomous targeting, and hypervelocity munitions, whether defensive or offensive, that's on the horizon, whether that's acknowledged or not. So with that, that concludes this episode. I will be sure to update the show notes. It should be mid-July that this episode is currently coming out. I wanted to thank all of my listeners and readers to my occasional essays at my Substack. I would urge you to go to my Substack, which is Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare Podcast, if you wish to comment, because I love receiving comments. And if you wish to talk to me, you can email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. This is Bill, out.